could reach your hand inside that helmet. I mean, you and I can easily scratch our nose if we get an itch. Inside that helmet, you can't scratch your nose. You can't wipe your eye if something goes into it. And if there's water floating around and droplets inside of the air, you got to be careful you don't breathe them. There's a lot of ways that spacesuit can give you a lot of grief. WS2N, K2IW.
I thought about it after this Luca Pamitano incident, and you know, why can't they have some kind of telescopic thing inside the helmet, you know, attached to maybe the neck part of it, you know, and then have it motorized and pneumatically operated, and you know, if you have a problem, you know, hit one of the buttons on the outside of your spacesuit and have this thing extend, you know, like right in front of your face, and move your head one way or the other, you know. But nobody's come up with that idea yet. And I think that would be, you know, have something with a hard piece on one end and then another piece with some kind of soft material if you're trying to get something moist that's stuck in your eye, you know. Give you a shot, you know. Why couldn't they come up with something like that? There's got to be a reason. And I'm sure it's not money. These things cost like $23 million each for each spacesuit. Back to you, Dick.
Dick, KT2OAS, I have an idea for that.
Okay, I'm going to pass it over to you in a second, Mark. Mark, is there a way you can feed an astronaut while he's in that spacesuit? Wasn't there a toothpaste tube that you can attach somewhere to the spacesuit and squeeze some food in there that he can eat and yet still maintain the air pressure? Over to you on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
I don't know about tubes, but I think solid types of things. I don't know. I don't know. It rings a bell. They've talked about that. But I don't know if they could take something in a tube and squeeze it out. I think they'd be more afraid of that getting loose inside the helmet. I don't know, when you're out there 6 to 8 hours, I don't think they're thinking about food, you know. And in an emergency situation like Pamitano, I'm sure he's, if he did another spacewalk, he wouldn't be thinking about food. They pulled him in an hour and a half, you know. At least with Cobra, he got like 4.5 hours, you know, they got most of the EVA done. But when Pamitano went out there, hour and a half later, and that was it. That prop creeped up right away. But no, I don't know about food, Dick. Back to you.
How about water? If you're out there for 7 hours without drinking, you're going to get awful dry. Is there any way he can drink something in that suit, Paul?
Yeah, I heard there is. Yeah, there is some kind of a thing right near your mouth. You can do that. How that's hooked up, I don't know. But it's probably hooked, but it's probably part of your, I don't think it's part of the suit. I think it's part of the internal clothing that you have on. Can't imagine that being part of the suit. Maybe it is, though. Back to you.
And if there's a way you can drink inside that suit, well, you got to do that very carefully, because, again, you could create droplets of water floating around in the air. KC2OIS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, roger that. I was thinking of some kind of vacuum tube with a diaphragm on it, so only you could only be sucking something out and not letting anything back in. That might be some kind of way of getting that out. But then again, I also saw a film. I don't know how incredible it is. I also saw a film that showed bubbles outside the helmet. So I don't know, you know, this is what my skepticism is about all this. If there's bubbles outside the helmet, was this filmed underwater? So now you're talking about the water being inside the suit. So wherever this goes, over to you, Dick.
Maybe it was the buoyancy lab in Texas.
Yeah, but in the buoyancy lab in Texas, you've got real local gravity. You're not going to get droplets of water floating freely in the air. Water is always heavier than air. It's going to go down to the bottom of whatever container it's in. Mark, from the way you're talking, are you one of the people who are a bit skeptical about whether or not the Apollo mission to the moon really took place? There is a fair number of people who believe that it really was a Hollywood production and that no one really went to the moon. And when I've met some of those people and I told them about me aiming a 3-degree beamwidth, 12-foot diameter antenna tuned to 2.3 gigahertz, aiming it at the moon while Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts were on the moon, and I heard that signal from that direction, and boy, did they get mad at me. Back to you for any comment on this one, Mark. KC2OIS, K2R.
Repeater, timeout.
You've got it, Mark.
1 second. Mark had said the bubbles were on the outside of the helmet. That's why I said the buoyancy, pool. Back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Mark.
Roger that. I do have some skepticism about all this. I'm not absolute about it, but I do believe that. So if we go back and we go back to the NASA X-15 project back in the 70s, them filming this and showing that the horizon is flat. Well, if the horizon is flat and you had an aircraft flying, you'd have to fly with your nose down all the time if the horizon wasn't flat. Or maybe you could respond to that.
Flying where? Doing what? I hear your words. I don't understand. What is the question, Mark? Back to you, Mark.
Going back to the experiments of the, it was called the X-15 rocket or something. Carried the rocket up by plane. NASA did this. I think it was in the 70s. The film, they're showing the horizon in the film and showing that the horizon is flat. So, we know a lot of these pictures that they take have, like, fish eyes. We know that the instruments on airplanes have fish eyes. So it does make it kind of round. There are possibilities that it could be flat.
If I remember correctly, the X-15 was carried under something like a B-52, probably launched at something like 35,000 feet. At 35,000 feet, you don't see Earth curvature. That horizon will look flat to you. Now, when it comes to wide-angle lenses, super wide-angle lenses, yes, everything looks distorted in funny ways. But there are kinds of lenses that are used for architectural photography where the curvature at the edge of the lens can be tuned out in the way you design the lens. So there's a zillion kinds of aspherical lenses, lenses with funny curvature characteristics that can give you pictures that'll give you all kinds of corrections. So the fact that somebody used a lens on a mission and the horizon looks flat, that doesn't bother me, Mark. Over to you, Mark. K2LAW.
Comment and one YDY.
All right, let the breaking station get in. Maybe he has something to contribute here. Go ahead.
N1YDY, go ahead.
Just going to comment on where you can observe the curvature of the Earth. You're correct that you can't see the 35, but at flight level 450, it's certainly visible to the guys flying the airplane, or at least I've seen it.
They were flying that plane, and they had some of that going at 315,000 miles. I think, I'm not sure, I don't know, I mean, I saw some film earlier today, but I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was higher than 35,000 miles.
Now, Hank is a pilot, and I think you're saying that you've flown as high as 45,000 feet, Hank, and you've seen the curvature of the Earth, is that what you're saying? N1YDY, K2LAW?
That's correct. I'm just saying that it's true you can't notice the curvature at 35, but if you're up at 45, flight level 450, then, you know, you can certainly see the, or notice the curvature of the Earth.
I'm curious, Hank, what kind of an aircraft were you in at 45,000 feet. Wait for the beeps. You've got to hang.
That was a Saberliner, an NA-65. Actually, I think it was an NA-39. The 65 was another version of the same airplane, but a North American Saberliner.
Is that pretty close to its altitude ceiling? Go ahead.
I think it was rated for 47, but I think I was at 450.
If anything goes wrong at that altitude and you have a sudden depressurization, my guess is life gets pretty complicated real fast. Is that true, Hank?
Well, that's true, but that's true at a much lower altitude. Anything above about 24,000, and you just have a number of minutes to get the oxygen mask on. And in that situation, the oxygen masks are what's called diluter demand. So it's a pressure fed at certain altitudes. And then when you get below the altitude at which you get a pressure feed, then you go to the diluter function. But that's just how they made the system work. And, you know, you have so many minutes to get the aircraft from altitude down to 12,000 feet, which is where you don't need oxygen anymore.
Question for the pilot, six.
Is there an altitude, Hank, at which an oxygen mask without pressurization might not be enough? And isn't 47,000 feet getting close to that point? N1YDY, K2RIW.
I think you're getting closer to 60,000 when you're starting to worry about an oxygen mask not being enough. Because, you know, when you get up in that height, if you look at what the Air Force used, they basically had the equivalent of Gemini astronaut suits used for high altitude flights, such as in the old SR-71 or the U-2. But for commercial aviation, you know, 45 is about as high as anything normally flies, and at that point, you know, the oxygen is delivered under pressure to you, so it's actually forcing the capillary action in your lungs. And then when you get low enough, or the cabin altitude gets low enough, then it goes to what I call the diluter demand. That's when you start mixing cabin atmosphere in with the oxygen that you breathe. Of course, you wouldn't do that if you had a fire. Of course, you want to keep the smoke out of your lungs, so you leave it at 100% that time.
In the case of a Saberliner, I'm not familiar with that aircraft. It has a model number called Saberliner. Is that is that something that carries 15 passengers, a little bit like a Learjet? What does that thing look like, Hank? Go ahead.
Well, it actually is of the same time frame as the early Lears. It's a little older, actually. It was the North American Rockwell companies, well, actually North America at the time, the North American company's first attempt at a commercial, I'm sorry, not a commercial, but a corporate level jet. The one I flew had six seats in the back and, of course, the two for the crew up front. Both the Air Force and the Navy operated a version of this aircraft, which was essentially the same, except that it had a bailout door right behind the pilot seats, and you could literally, the aircraft was depressurized, you could literally open a door and jump out. Of course, the civilian versions didn't have anything like that. It was all welded shut down there.
So in other words, there are commercial services at one time that used Saberliners, is what I think you're saying. I presume this is a corporate jet-like situation, not normal shuttle passengers. Go ahead.
No, it was a corporate aircraft. It was, you know, like I said, it was six passengers in the back, and it was certainly not something that that anybody would buy a ticket on. I mean, your company owned one, or at least in the case of the company I was working for at the time, actually was an older aircraft at the time, and the guy who owned it was a very wealthy private individual. He owned a number of what you might call supermarkets. I'm trying to remember the exact brand. It was X something or another. They were in South Florida at the time. But, you know, I'm talking in the, let's see, that would be in the mid-80s, early 80s. So, you know, it's a while back. And the airplane was quite old already. The airplane was built in the late 60s.
What's the approximate maximum speed of a Sabreliner and maximum speed of a Learjet? Wait for the beeps and you've got it, Hank.
Well, essentially, any jet aircraft is going to operate, the subsonic is going to operate at about 400, between 420 and 440 knots. That's what your flight plan for.
And commercial airliners, what's the maximum speed that they fly at?
And it's the same range. It's a function of the way turbojet and turbofan engines work. Is they're only efficient at higher altitudes and higher speeds. You know, it's in the same way that propeller aircraft basically are efficient at about 250 to 300 knots. A jet airplane is efficient at between 400 and 440 knots. I haven't seen anything that was really flight planned faster than 440, although I think maybe the old Convair 990 might have been a little bit faster, but, you know, most of the time what guys do is they actually use, you know, Mach numbers for separation in flight, so, you know, most aircraft that are commercially operated are operated in the 0.76 to 0.80 range. The Grumman Gulfstreams were in the 0.82 range for flight planning, but that's just for spacing and route.
So 0.8 Mach, I think you're saying, is about the maximum. I presume the engine is starting to consume a lot more fuel if you decided to go that fast. Is that true?
I'm sure there's something to do with the engine, but the real liability on any airframe becomes what's called the critical Mach number, which is the speed at or above which some part of the airframe is going supersonic. The easy way to perceive it, and I know you're not a big fan of Bernoulli, but if you look at the front of a 747, the critical Mach number on that airplane is just in the, is determined by the airflow just on the backside of the hump and the top. And you can almost imagine this as you look at the shape of the thing, that if the whole airplane is moving at one speed through the air, that the air going over the back of the hump has water from the thing not to have separation there. So it's that's usually how the maximum speed is determined. Although, you know, a turbofan aircraft is going to be, or engined aircraft is going to be more efficient than a turbojet engined aircraft when you are at lower altitude, and the turbojet is more efficient when you're at higher altitudes, but it's just a function of where the aircraft is optimized for flight.
At high speeds, high altitude, you want the air over the top of the wing to hug the wing. Boundary layer-like effects. The canola effect is what makes the air stick to the wing. I think you're saying that beyond a certain velocity, the canola effect starts breaking down. Is that one way of looking at it, Hank, K2RAW?
It's separation. You know, it's in the same way that a wing can stall. As the plane gets higher and higher, the difference in speed between the minimum speed at which it can fly, that's the stall speed, and the maximum speed at which it can fly, which is going to be this critical Mach number, that range of flight becomes smaller and smaller until you get to a point at which the aircraft simply can only fly at one speed at a given altitude. And as you go down and the air becomes both warmer and denser, then these two numbers diverge. But you get to a certain point where they converge, and that is a function of altitude and speed. And once you get to that point, you can neither go faster nor slower without having adverse effects on the airframe. But, you know, the basic comment I wanted to make was, you know, what I was saying in the front, that basically these things go about 440 knots, and they don't really go much faster than that unless you've got a supersonic aircraft. And at the altitude, the max altitude at which, you know, I'd seen the curvature of the Earth was about 45,000 feet. That's really the point I was trying to bring up. And one YDY.
question for Hank, WS2N.
You got a ball. Wait for the beeps.
I often wonder, you know, if you take a jet and you're flying, let's say, 35,000 feet, where a lot of jets are, and they're flying, we use Mach numbers, but let's say they're going at 600 miles an hour. It, you know, what would happen if you cut it in half or even less than that? Can it, how slow can a jet go at 35,000 feet? It's a very low pressure. I think it's like 5-6 pounds or something like that, 7 pounds of pressure outside. So is it a function of the airframe of the plane that would make it stall, or would the engine itself stall because now you're not getting enough oxygen and if you're not moving fast enough? Back to you, Hank.
Paul, if I understand the question correctly, it's the airframe. And again, I was talking about that convergence of the stall speed, which is as slow as it can go. If you go any slower, the wing quits flying. And then there's the maximum or airspeed, critical Mach number you can call it, or MMO, which is the maximum operating Mach number, MMO. Essentially, you know, it's the two numbers, as the altitude goes up, the two numbers become closer to the point where you can't go slower and you can't go faster. The pilots actually call that coffin corner. And the higher you get, the closer to the edges of the performance envelope that you get. You probably heard guys talking about pushing the envelope, whether being on one side of the envelope or the other. And that's literally what they're talking about is they go higher, they can't go faster, and they can't go slower, and they become stuck at a certain speed. They have to descend before they can do anything else. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but I can send you a link on your email if you'd like. That would probably be a little more eloquent than I am.
Very good, Hank. Yeah, okay. Anytime you want to send me anything, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com. Anytime. Okay, very good. Yeah, I'm imagining the engine, you know, at low altitude, 14.7 pounds, you know, having plenty of oxygen going in, and, you know, but yet you go up to a higher altitude, and you're getting less oxygen. But okay, it's a function of the frame itself and the way the plane is shaped, and, pushing the envelope. Okay, now I know where that came from. And usually, if it doesn't go right, you always heard the other saying that they bought the farm. back to you, Dick. WS2N.
One more comment to Paul.
KA2YHY recognized, but we're going to go back to Hank first. And I've got one hell of a question for you, Hank, when I get a chance. I think it's Hank. Go ahead, Hank.
Paul, you can make an engine will still run when you're at high altitude. You've got most turbofan engines that are in modern jets have between 6 and 9 stages of compression, which are the first spools that you see, the fan blades that are turning. If you look at the inlet of a jet engine when it's sitting on the ramp, a lot of times you can actually hear the wind that's blowing just cause them to slowly turn over, and they make a ticking sound. Where I'm going with that engine will operate at faster speeds as long as it's not supersonic. When you get to supersonic speeds, and then you've got compressibility issues, and the compressor literally stalls, so those stages don't work. In fact, if you look at jet fighters, they have a bunch of ramps that slow down the air reaching into an engine so that it's subsonic when it actually gets to the compressor stage. I think that pretty much covers it, unless you have any other questions. But with that, back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Hank. Very good. That's what I was looking for. Very good. Thank you. Dick?
Yeah, I think I heard Steve signing in by Echo Link or something like that. K-A-2-Y-H-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, yeah, very good. And you need more stuff we can talk about, like you have. After that, maybe you could tell me why Sunblock has avoided you from this policy. That was the question.
Steve, your audio is extremely low. Maybe you're being quiet because you don't want to wake people up in the house. and you asked me something about Apollo 16. It was Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 where, with my equipment, S-band downlink receiver, ground station, homebrew ground station, I was listening to the astronauts directly on the moon of Apollo 15 and Apollo 16. So what was your question about Apollo 16? Nobody was restricting me, if that's what you're asking. Over to you, Steve, and give us a lot more audio. Either eat that microphone or shout into it.
I heard the question, Dick, if you want me to repeat it.
Yeah, let me let Steve repeat the question. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, okay, very good. I'll speak a little louder. This is an iPad I'm using. What did they get annoyed at you about? You said they got annoyed at you. What was the question?
It isn't they that got annoyed. It was Deke Slayton. Deke Slayton had some kind of a medical condition where, although he was an astronaut, he was not allowed to fly. Therefore, he was head of astronaut training. I met him after Apollo 15 when I had a trip down to the Houston Space Center, and I did get a chance to see him face to face. He was my introduction. Somebody was introducing me to Deke Slayton. He had a scowl on his face because, being in charge of astronaut audio, the S-band microwave link between his astronauts and the ground stations, he considered that his very private communication channel. And in front of him was a man named Dick Nadel, who was giving him evidence that it was becoming a party line, that other people were listening into this private channel. So because of the lack of privacy of his astronauts, that's my interpretation. He had a scowl on his face when I was being introduced to him, and they were telling him what I had done and what I was doing. And he didn't say anything directly, but the scowl on his face told me he wasn't happy that I was there, and had been doing that. Over to you, Steve, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. Thank you for answering the question. I don't think you did anything in question. K-A-2-Y-H-Y. Carry on. Thank you.
Now, Hank, you being a pilot from way back, might be able to answer this question. As you know, there was a major airline crash in the Soviet Union about 2 weeks ago. And some very important people were on that airplane. One of their major bands or choral group was on that plane. And the plane crashed into the water with no report from the pilot. It just suddenly disappeared from the radar screen. Somewhere in one of the reports, I heard one single word, flap retraction. In other words, at the time they were retracting the flaps is when the accident occurred. It apparently happened so fast, the pilot never had a chance to holler mayday or say anything. As you know, a pilot has got three things in his priority. Aviate, navigate, communicate, in that order. I'm guessing he was aviating and maybe navigating, and he never had a chance to communicate. My guess is that if you're retracting the flaps 2 minutes after takeoff, and if anything goes wrong, that one flap retracts slower than the other, my guess is that can create an aileron effect that can be so severe that it can flip you upside down. I imagine that under normal circumstances, let me drop. I'm guessing that under normal circumstances, those flaps are mechanically connected together so that they must retract equally on each side. And if anything goes wrong, you retract the flap on one side and at the other side. Don't realize it and reverse it. My guess is you can be in a heap of trouble in a hurry. Therefore, I'm making a guess that the flaps could have been a contributing factor to that air accident. N1YDY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think you're probably right, Dick. You know, the aircraft involved was a very old copy of the 727. Take a look at it. And the Soviets, when they were building aircraft, didn't require that they adhere to the same design standards and performance standards that the FAA has, the rest of the world has required. So I'm not familiar with the aircraft other than, gee, I recognize one two out of three times, but I certainly haven't flown one, and I really can't tell you that this is right, but my guess would be that, you know, what you're describing is what happened. I can only tell you that if that happened in the U.S., or an airplane that's certified in the U.S., or that you wouldn't have that same problem, because of the speed that you'd be flying when you go to retract the flaps, you would have enough aileron authority to counteract any roll commands that an asymmetrical flap or slat retraction would give you. And this is by design in the aircraft. The old NG80s and DC-9s that I flew years ago were actually some of the simulator training that you got to fly them when you first certified or checked out as a captain included that. And it was more of a demonstration to show the new captain that, you know, you can fly the aircraft in a number of unlikely configurations. But, again, I think the Soviets didn't use that same set of design parameters or performance for standards when they were first certifying aircraft. And with that, guys, I got to hit the bathroom, so I'm going to say 73, but I'll come back in a couple of minutes. And one YDY.
Yeah, thank you, Hank. And when you come back, I'm going to ask you, have there been any incidents where American aircraft have had unequal flap retraction or deployment? K2RIW listening.
Quick answer to that is yes. It's happened. It's not been catastrophic, but it hasn't happened in a long time, and it wasn't flaps. Usually the flaps are what's called cable bust, and it just means that there's wires, or actually cables, that are causing one flap to follow the other. So if an actuator failed on one side but not on the other, the working actuator would drive the flap it's connected to, and the other flap would then follow because of this cable bus. What has happened in the U.S. is the difference between the leading edge device, which are usually slats but can be leading edge flaps, Kruger flaps, but are usually slats, and sometimes the slats will retract and the flaps didn't, or vice versa. And that's happened. It's been non-events when it's happened.
So if one slat retracted and the other didn't, you're saying it wouldn't create a very strong roll response?
Not a super strong one. You know, certainly one that, you know, you could easily counter. In fact, there's a, I don't remember the number now, but there's a crossover airspeed. At one point, let's say you got the DC-9 with the 30 series wing, which was the standard DC-9 that was flown for many years. If one of the slats retracted and you were going faster than, I think the number is 230, but I don't remember, and you're going faster than 230, the drag associated with the one that remained out causes the aircraft to roll in one direction. If you're going slower than that number, then the lift that's associated with the slat remaining extended causes the aircraft to roll in the opposite direction. Again, it's something for which the U.S. manufacturers have either bust the systems together or demonstrated that the aircraft can fly in that configuration.
And beyond that particular velocity, you have enough authority of the aileron to compensate, and maybe enough of rudder authority because of the adverse yaw of differential drag. Interesting. Okay, I guess, let me drop for a minute. I think you've given us a space report 234. You called it B. I would call it A. B. We'll call it B, where you've given us the rundown of everything that took place in the year 2016. And is there a 234A report on what has happened the last week, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW in the TechNet?
Yeah, well, part of it was the spacewalk, of course, that took place Friday, that we talked about, and also going to take place again this Friday. And then SpaceX is going to return to flight, as you know, September 1st, they had an explosion on Launch Complex 40. They're still trying to rebuild that pad. And that destroyed the satellite that was on top of it, called the AMOS-6 satellite, and destroy the whole rocket complex. It was all ruined, and nobody got hurt, but they had to track down this problem. The last couple of flights that they would, I guess the last five flights, they were doing what they called densification of the, not only the oxygen, but the fuel itself, bringing the fuel down 50 degrees below its normal temperature, and the fuel is kerosene, and that densifies. You can get more fuel in a tank. The same with the oxygen. You bring that down to almost 300 degrees. That's the normal liquid oxygen tank. I think it's 298 or something. But then he brings it below that, another 50 degrees. You can get more oxygen in a tank. So he was doing this, and he was successfully doing it. He was getting 30% more fuel out of each Falcon 9 rocket. Let me drop it. And what happened on September 1st was he was going through the same process, getting very confident, and he had the satellite on top. Instead of leaving the satellite in the facility and then testing the rocket, you know, you always have to test the rocket a day or two before launch. And when I say test, they light the rockets for a couple of seconds, then they shut them right down. They're being held down to the pad, and they always do this. But to do it, he needed to fuel the rocket. But this time, they did an investigation. It looks like they have three helium tanks on board, and they're encased inside the oxygen tank. And these helium tanks, they have a purpose. When you're launching, after you've launched, fuel and oxygen is leaving the spacecraft and going out the exhaust. You have to keep the rest of the tank pressurized, and they do that with these highly pressurized helium tanks. And they're very cold too, because they're inside this cold oxygen tank. So what happened is the outside got, you know, of the tank actually got so cold that the oxygen on the outside of the tank started to densify to the point where it started to turn to a solid, and got in between. The tank is composed of, it's an aluminum tank, and then it's got this composite wrap around it. You can imagine this aluminum tank with like tape going all the way around this composite wrap, and apparently the solidness of the oxygen was getting trapped in between the tape and the composite wrap, I'm going to call it the tape, and the tank itself, and then compressed it. It actually started to compress the tank, and it piercing the tank, and this sudden piercing of it, they think created an ignition. Now, anything to do with carbon, which is the carbon wrap going around the tank, and the oxygen ignites and blew up the whole tank, blew up the oxygen tank, blew up the spacecraft above, and the whole launch complex itself. And this was located all in the second stage. So they think they have a handle on this. They're going to do things differently. And they are now returning to launch. It's already been delayed a couple of days. They're having trouble getting a license from the FCC to resume. Now, I just read on spacenews.com, which is pretty reliable, that they did get their license to resume. It was supposed to go off on the 8th, and it was shifted to the 9th. And last I heard, it's the 14th, but that's not written in stone. But they plan on launching not from Cape Canaveral, but from Vandenberg Air Force Base. They have the their own launch complex there that they built up, and they're going to be launching the 10 Iridium satellites. Let me drop it. I think they call it Next Iridium or Iridium Next, but there are more of these Iridium satellites. So the first group of them, out of dozens, I think they've got like 10 flights scheduled with SpaceX to do this. So, you know, maybe 100 of these satellites will be going up over time. Some large amount, anyway. But it's, that's going to be their first return to flight launch. They have another one scheduled, you know, also at the end of the month. But I really don't know when that's going to go off. And that's down in Florida. They plan on launching not from Launch Complex 40, because they blew it up. They're still working on that. But from Launch Complex 39A. 39B is the one that NASA is working with for the Space Launch System. They turned over 39A to SpaceX. And they plan on eventually launching people from 39A. So they're building a gantry and all of this, you know, a way to get people up there. And they weren't planning on using this for regular flights just yet, regular Falcon 9 flights. They were just going to use it for Falcon 9 for people and Falcon 9 Heavy. Falcon 9 Heavy is three Falcon 9s strapped together. And that was supposed to go off in 2013, 3 years ago. So that's way behind schedule. But maybe that'll go, you know, probably maybe the end of this year. And that's the story on SpaceX. So I'm expecting the earliest the 14th to see another flight, see if they can get back into a rhythm. They were doing quite well until they were...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Paul, what is SpaceX going to do to correct the condition of the buildup of that material between the wrap and the tank? How are they going to avoid that problem, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything. They're not releasing that to the public, but they've released the information to the FCC, from what I've read. I would imagine that we'll get an answer to that. But apparently they've satisfied the FCC to return, and they said that they're going to do something differently. So what that is, I don't know. The only thing positive that I know they're doing differently is they're not going to put the 10 Iridium satellites on board when they do their test fire, which they did, by the way, they did their test fire, I think, yesterday. So now the rocket gets brought back to the preparation facility, and they're going to attach the satellites now, bring it out, and then refuel it again, and then launch this thing. The earliest would be the 14th. They said in the future Falcon 9 rockets are going to be built a little bit differently, and again, they haven't said what they're going to do. In fact, they did say that they're not going to release that information. I guess it's proprietary information, I assume. Back to you, Dick.
By bringing the fuels down to a super cold temperature, the fuel becomes more dense. But you said they can put 30% more fuel and more oxygen with these super cooling techniques. Does the fuel compress that much as a function of temperature? Over to you, Paul.
It does compress a lot, they said, and, you know, whether it's 30%, you know, they do say 30% more lift capability, so maybe between the two stages, they both get densified, and maybe there's a better thrust, I think the word is IPS. The ratio between, you know, for what they can do on a rocket, you know, I think that number might be improved. But yes, it's definitely denser where they, you know, you could lift a lot of heavy weight. Now, this launch is going to be the heaviest thing that they put into orbit so far. total weight is 20,000 pounds with all these satellites. Each satellite is 2,000 pounds. There's 10 of them. So SpaceX is really really out there with this. All right, they're going into, I think, probably, you know, 400, maybe 400-mile orbits or something. But still, 20,000 pounds is a lot. By the way, I got an update on how heavy the Hubble was. Remember, we were talking about that last week. I got the answer on that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think I found that Hubble was something like 25,000 pounds. And I think that the infrared job, I can't think of the name of it.
James Webb.
Yeah, I think James Webb is something like 14,500, almost 15,000. I think James Webb is 15,000 and Hubble was something like 25,000. Are those roughly the numbers? I'm amazed that James Webb is that light. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I know, so am I, but it is going out to a million miles, so it's a lot further than Hubble. Hubble's what, 400, 450 or something? Maybe 350, between 350 and 400, I think Hubble is. Whatever. I know it's a lot higher than the space station at 250. Space station's 250. Yeah, I found 24,500. I was guessing, remember, I was guessing 30,000 pounds last week. I had that in my head from way back when. But it turns out it was 24,500 pounds. Close enough. So, okay, so James Webb is less. Well, it's going all the way out, four times the distance of the moon, almost a million miles out there. So, you know, that's probably the limit. They base everything around what they can launch. They know they were going up in the Ariane 5 rocket. And then, by the way, it's going to take 6 months to calibrate this thing after it's in orbit. I just read that the other day. I had that on my this week's report, that even after it's launched, 6 months, now NASA is turning to the science community and asking them, now, what do you want us to point this thing at? It's time to start submitting your request. Back to you, Dick. WS20.
SpaceX is about to launch 10 Iridium satellites. I think you said 20,000 pounds total. Can you imagine the value in dollars of 10 Iridium satellites? If they have a failure of this particular launch, there's a lot of bucks involved. That insurance policy must be kind of fierce on the premiums. Over to you, Paul.
Iridium said they have faith in them in doing it, so we'll see. And I think there's, it's either 7 or 10, I forget, but it's one of those, 7 or 10 more launches for Iridium. So that's pretty incredible. And it's Iridium next, so these are new and improved. So we'll see how they do, but there's going to be an awful lot of these satellites. And I think we're going to see more and more of that as time goes on. You know, SpaceX wants to build like a factory, put like 900? So I think 1,200 or more satellites up into space. Another company wants to put up 900 of them. You know, it's going to get to the point we won't be able to see the sun in daytime. Back to you, Dick.
Iridium originally was supposed to be a commercial product, and I think it didn't turn out to be financially beneficial. I think Iridium is now a military product, and is that who's financing this? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if sure maybe the military uses it, but I don't know much of that. I know Iridium was supposed to be 77 satellites. Because that's where they got the name Iridium, because it was 77 periodic tables at 77. But then they decided to cut the numbers and they went down to 66 satellites. They didn't need 77, but they kept the name. And then it wasn't working out, like you said. It wasn't working out. I think they turned that around. They have users And I know Eric is up on that. Eric was on up on who's using these things. I know I'm not. I just know that this is like, you know, Iridium 2.0, you know. Back to you, Dick.
The actual handy-talkie that you hold on to when talking to Iridium, I seem to remember it's a rather large brick-like device. Kind of heavy, kind of expensive, probably limited in talk time. And so I'm guessing that's part of the limitation. To talk directly to a satellite requires a lot of uplink power and a lot of downlink power. So I'm guessing only the rather rich clients and military are really using it. WPOL, K2RIW.
Yeah, probably the way it is now, but with these new ones going up, I think Eric said you could be able, you'd be able to use something similar to what you use with your cell phone. By the way, on the this net, the 234A net, space net report, I had something about the James Webb Space Telescope. I think I pointed it out a week or two ago, a couple of weeks ago, that they had problems. There was vibration tests. They had these vibration tests, and these accelerometers showed that there was a problem, and they took it out of this chamber. They looked into it. So far, they determined that no damage was done. The test was stopped immediately when they got this result. And you know, now they're looking into it. Now they're looking to retest the James Webb Space Telescope, but they don't think there's any problems. And one of the questions was, is this going to delay it? You know, they shoot for 2018 launch, and the answer is right now no. That's all figured in. They left enough time in case there were problems. Back to you, Dick.
That's pretty good. 10 Iridium satellites in one launch. Wow. And I think you're saying now when they do that test firing, they do it without the payload on board just in case there's a failure. The case of the helium tanks that are inside to pressurize the oxygen or fuel, I'm amazed that they have to have a separate gas to pressurize. Whenever you watch them launching fuel, installing fuel on a rocket on the launch pad, you always see a whole lot of boil off taking place. So if they just close off the valve that does the boil off, doesn't that pressurize the tank? Why is a separate pressurization required? Or, because of supercooling it, maybe the boil-off is too slow, you would think they could just put a small heater in one corner of the fuel and force a little bit of the fuel to boil off as a way of doing pressurization, and therefore not need the completely separate helium tanks. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Well, it's after the launch of the rocket. You know, the first stage and second stage, they need to keep pressure within inside that tank. In fact, they say a lot of these tanks are, if they're completely empty, they start to collapse. But they need to keep them pressurized. And to do that, they use an inert gas like helium. I don't know why they don't use nitrogen, but they use helium. Maybe has to do with cost or something. But they do use helium to keep the tanks pressurized. And I think that's what you're getting at. It has nothing to do with the keeping it cool, we'll call that, on a launch pad. You know, they have cryogenic coolers before all the stuff is pumped in. And it takes them like a half hour to pump it in. Which normally, without the super cooling, they could pump it in a couple of hours before, 4 or 5 hours before, no problem. And stop it, one of the astronauts, you know, the early astronauts in the Gemini program and eventually Apollo, wrote a letter to NASA and told them, what are you doing with SpaceX? You know, they're loading this an hour, half hour before, watch. You're eventually going to put people in this thing. Let me drop it. Falcon 9 is designed to carry people. And, you know, we don't want you, this, you know, standard operation at the for launching people is, you know, you'll fill the tanks up, you'll test everything, make sure everything's okay, and then you'll put people on board. You don't put people on board and then sit there and fill the tanks with all this cryogenic propellant with people sitting up there, you know, half hour before you go, you know. So I think SpaceX is going to have some problems. They might have to change something. This is right about that. It's too dangerous. So, but I read maybe three or four reports about the story, and now I haven't heard anything in the last month. Well, I'm sure I'm going to hear more about this. Back to you, Dick.
Well, you've got the escape mechanism for the astronauts. So if anything goes wrong while you're loading the fuel with the astronauts on first, you can always deploy the escape mechanism. It's not friendly, but at least it's one way to go. But in the old days, you would burn up all the fuel in the tank, and then the early stage boosters would themselves fall back to Earth and or burn up in the atmosphere. So if the tank collapsed, you didn't care. Now that you're bringing that first or second stage booster back down and landing it tail first, you have to have the tanks inflated. So I can see now why that helium is required. I'm guessing once the fuel is out of the tank, they close off the valve in the tank and start deploying the helium to keep the tank inflated in order to make that booster landing. Is that correct, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
They like to have the helium in there as the fuel is getting, you know, getting picked up by the pumps. You know, without having the helium, you'd start to create a vacuum in the tank as the stuff is being sucked through the pumps. So that's why the helium's there. And the first stage, that's not collapsible. You could, but the second stage is. But the first stage has been reinforced. You know, that could be, you can stand that up without it collapsing. But they say the second stage isn't built like that yet. So we'll have to see. Also, on my list, I had two missions that have been approved by NASA, but they're many years from now. So, you know, one of them is going to go to, you know, where the Trojan asteroids are. You know, at the Trojan point for Jupiter, a lot of different Trojan points depending on what we're talking about. But they want to go visit the Trojan asteroids at L5 and at L4 out near Jupiter. So that's going to be next big mission for robotic science. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so the fuel is boiling off of the tank, but it boils off too slowly compared to the rate at which you're taking fuel out of the tank during the actual thrusting action. That's why you need the helium on the second stage. That makes some sense. Okay, I think I can sort of see that one. When it comes to the approval for launch on SpaceX in the next few days, you said they need FCC approval. I wonder if you meant FAA approval. Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
Yeah. Being a ham, FCC is first thing that comes out of my mouth. FAA approval. But, I just wanted to, just look for the name. Lucy is the name of the mission that's going to be going to the Trojan system near Jupiter. We got to wait till launch on 2021. So wow, that's five years. No, let's see, 2017. Probably 4 or 5 years down the road. There's another one as well that's going to go to another asteroid. But Lucy is the real interesting one. It's going to go to L5. Visit a half a dozen of these asteroids, and then it's going to come back toward Earth. Get a gravity assist around Earth, and then it's going to go out to the L4 group. I can't imagine this thing being approved, but they said it is. Back to you, Dick.
WHY1.